Okay. Good evening, everybody. It's lovely to see you. Dobby, are there some reason that you're not coming in?
It's a holy spiritual cabalistic reason.
Really? It's, okay. Is everything all right there?
It's a baby.
It's a baby.
You have a baby? Right there?
She's just out of your line of vision.
I can't see. You're just there. It's very unusual what you're doing. Okay. I don't really know what's going on. And I can't explain. It's just really weird. It's like
it did look very...
It's a bit weird.
The baby ball alerted it and W.
Okay. When you're done, and are you going to come in later or not?
No.
Okay.
No, I am.
Okay, you are going to come in.
Yeah.
All right, fantastic. When you do come in, can you shut your door behind you? That's all I'm asking. Okay.
Wow. Okay, fantastic. Everybody, welcome back. Welcome to 3 out of 6 of the Jewish Philosophy Course here at Whitefield Forum. So exciting. Now, I've left some more cards here at the front with my address and details on, because I've been starting to get a flurry of questions coming in by email by people that either feel uncomfortable to ask questions here or don't frankly want to wait for me to get through the questions when people wait at the end. So they basically email me questions. If you would like to email questions, you don't have my email address. It's right there on the card should anyone need it. Derech Hashem Sfarim, if you have one at home, borrow one tonight. Otherwise, please keep one if you need to take one. Is everyone okay with that? Now, I've had lots and lots of... Now, last week, the recording didn't work. I'm really, really sorry about that. So many people said, please, can I listen to the recording? People who weren't able to make it said, please, can I get a copy of the recording? And it just didn't work. And a lot of people have said, please, could we have a recap? Now, I remember last week, I asked, would you mind going over the Blue Orange again for those individuals that missed the Blue Orange? And everyone said, yeah, we don't want to go over it again, so forget it. Let's move forward. So now I'm going to ask again, because so many people have asked, do you want me to do a recap of last week's session? So for those that do want a recap, no, it's not fair because you weren't there last week.
I don't get a vote.
Please put your hand up. No. All those, including you, or Mrs. Goodwill, putting you, all those that would like to do a recap of last week, could you just raise your hands? Wow, sorry. All those that don't want a recap from last week, could you raise your hands? Go on, be honest, Paul. Don't want to recap. No. So what's your name at the...
Richard.
Richard doesn't want to recap. Paul doesn't want... It's just Richard and Paul. And we said, Richard and Paul. I'll tell you what I'm going to do, because I feel really bad for Richard and Paul. Richard doesn't want to do this. He's fine with it. You know, Paul's fine
with discounts.
Common will be giving out discounts for Richard and Paul. Goodness gracious me. Okay, well, this is going to hold us up a little bit. Okay, are you happy to do a recap?
Do a wee bit.
Okay. Last week, we had possibly the most intense session, I think it's fair to say, for all those that were there, that was available. Is that true? Do you agree with that? It was very intense. And the reason why it was so intense was because the material that we were discussing was the most profound and most abstract material that can be discussed by human beings. Now, that sounds very arrogant, doesn't it? Like, how could we... If we were talking about, as I said, I think the example I gave was doing calculus on the 27th dimension and things like that. That's nothing compared to what we discussed last night or last week. The reason for that is because whatever you're discussing, it's never as abstract and never as important as what we were discussing last week. Because what we discussed last week was the ultimate level of abstraction to the point that we started to run out of words. And I think there's a gentleman at the back that started asking questions and we actually ran out of words. There were no words to clothe the concepts that we were discussing. We'd literally reached a service ceiling of mental ability and language ability where the words that we were saying stopped having meaning. And that's very intense. So that was very intense for a lot of people. I don't really want to spend this session doing that again because I really want to finish this entire chapter and get to the second chapter, which is the purpose of creation, which is a lovely one to knock out in an hour because most people think it takes ages. It's really quite simple. But this is quite tough stuff. We only managed to get through 4 sentences, I believe, last week. And we talked about, if you have a look on page 31, I'm going to run very quick. I remember I spoke to Kobe last week, and we asked the difference between knowing and believing. And we went through the difference that there's knowing something is data that you have looked at, you've questioned it, and you know something because of it. And there's belief. There's 2 types of belief. We discussed that there was belief, simple belief, which is that I don't know how something works, but I accept it anyway. And there's the more advanced belief, which is a belief that you've worked through to such an extent, you've done such empirical scientific... Do you need another copy of the book? Belief that you've worked through to such an extent, you've worked so incredibly hard, that you've actually consigned it to a certain file in your mind where you no longer question it. We talked about Kobe's telephone number. He believes his number's his telephone number. He doesn't know it anymore. He has dialed it so many times, the phone rings so many times, he no longer questions it, he no longer tests it to see if it's working. It's an absolute set belief in his mind. Remember that? We talked about that. So we got knowledge and belief down. Knowledge and belief are two different things. And what many people think of belief is really quite a Christian concept of belief, saying, I believe. Right, I can't believe I'm recording this, and this may end up on the MH website. So it's like, it's imagine like take the same. I believe, yes, sir. Yes, sir. I can't believe I just did that. Okay, so that kind of belief is not the belief that we're talking about. Because that belief is saying, I have no idea how that works, and I just decide to believe it. Now, the problem with that is you can buy into anything. You can just believe that the world is a giant carrot, and that we are being run by a huge rabbit who is slowly gnawing away at the carrot, and then the carrot will disappear and we'll all fall off the earth. I just believe it. I have no empirical data. No one's ever told me about that. I just believe it. Now, that's obviously not true. But you could still nonetheless believe that if you so wanted. That's not the belief we were talking about. We're talking about the fact I've worked it through so hard that I believe that this is so true that I no longer need to question it. Right? Okay. That was the first sentence. The second sentence, well, we took more time about it, but the second sentence, a little bit of a quick recap here, was extremely intense. We discussed the fact that, by the way, for people here who have not been to lecture 1 and 2, okay, I just need to get a proviso out here. I'm not trying to convince you, and I'm going to constantly say this is my pet topic, I'm not trying to convince you what to believe. I'm not here to try to tell you this is what's true. I'm not here to try to tell you this is what's true, and if you don't, I'm not trying to do any of that. I'm just merely trying to tell you what Jewish philosophy says about stuff. Then you can go around and say, well, at least I know what Jewish philosophy says about it. If anyone asks you, you can say this is the answer Jewish philosophy gives. Okay? It's not what I necessarily believe. It's what Judaism says. Orthodox classical Judaism, with all the sources all backed up, says X. So then we talked about the fact that Judaism believes, I'm using my words very carefully, Judaism believes that there is a being who wasn't created, and that this being is the absolute source of everything, creates everything at every moment, is 100% simple, i.e. this being has no component parts. It doesn't have a mouth, doesn't have eyes, doesn't have a body. And we discussed how he's not even in this dimension. And we used last time and the time before that the concept of a 2D world, the Flatlanders. And if you were to put your head down onto a 2D world and go hello to the 2D people, they would not be able to perceive you. Because you simply have, they just can't, their eyes can't perceive you. We also did the famous, by now, people have been walking up to me in the street, going, blue orange! And people have been talking about blue orange, the blue orange! And that was a meditative kind of tool which we used to imagine something with great detail, and we explained that the blue orange was real in our mind, but not real in the physical world. Which means that the blue orange is less real than we are. Everyone up to scratch so far, so good. Is that good for everyone so far? Apart from the fact that the blue orange is not as real as we are, which means there are different levels of reality, the blue orange cannot exist unless we are constantly energizing and thinking about the blue orange. The second we stop thinking about the blue orange, it disappears. We then used those analogies to explain the fact that this being that we're talking about in this book is more real than us, which is why we couldn't possibly perceive him or see him, which is why he's invisible. You can't possibly clothe it in any concept because it's not in our dimension. And two, that this being must be constantly thinking about us because we're blue oranges in relation to that being. There are limitations to this analogy, as we'll get to on the next few pages, but that's what the tool that we used. Is everyone up to speed on the blue orange, the 2D world, and the fact that there's a primordial being who has no beginning, no end, and is infinite? Well, that's good. And then, we had a really long talk. There was a lady here who's not here this week, but asked brilliant questions, really, really good questions. We talked about the fact that this being is absolutely perfect. And we needed to define perfection. And we defined perfection as a complete and total lack of any deficiency whatsoever. And we had a big problem when we talked about that. First of all, there was a whip round for my luxury yacht in St. Moritz. Do you remember that? I had a whip round and I wanted a yacht in St. Moritz because it's my birthday in July and I really liked the idea. And then I pointed out, oh God, and then Paul pointed out, there's no point getting him this yacht because he'll just moan and complain if he gets it, which is true. I'll moan about the port fees and I'll moan about the careening and I'll moan about all the people not turning up and the staff not cleaning it. And all those things which are good come with drawbacks. And there is nothing perfect in the physical world. We've never experienced perfection ever. We just have various levels of imperfection. Some are less imperfect than others, and that's what makes them better in our lives. But everything, like you have the most beautiful big 50-carat diamond that's awarded to you, you'd better find a bank vault somewhere to keep it because you wouldn't want to keep that thing at home. You know, 50-carat diamond, how many tens of millions back? You just wouldn't feel safe. That's a negative drawback of that diamond. Therefore, nothing is perfect. This being that we're talking about is totally devoid of any deficiency whatsoever, which means there's lots he can't do. And that busted the nursery rhyme concept of the creator that we had last time. The God can do anything he wants. Absolutely no, he can't. No, he can't. He can't do anything he wants because he can only want what he can do. So we talked about the fact, could God get any better at spelling? Could God get any better at mathematics? Could God win a chess game where he's only got one piece and you've got a full set? And the answer to all these things is obviously not. Because if he could get better at spelling, that means he didn't know how to spell previously. If he could get a better at maths, that means there's something in mathematics which he isn't completely clear on until he just... He can't get better at anything. He can't develop. He can't grow. He can't go anywhere he isn't already. He's totally still. In fact, he's completely limited by the boundaries of his own perfection. Then, I think it was Sarah who was here, asked a brilliant question. Really an outstanding question, and I'd just like to repeat it. She said, well, if this being is so perfect, how come everything he creates is imperfect? That's a brilliant question. Isn't that a brilliant question she asked? If he's so good, why can't he make something that's really good? Oh, that was a brilliantly brilliant... I just really enjoy that question. I said last time we should always enjoy a question. Remember, one good question is worth several lousy answers. It really is. Now, I think there's a point that many, many lousy answers start to outweigh a question. You start getting tired of it all. But a really good question should be enjoyed in of itself. And you should enjoy a good question. She asked, well, if he's so good at everything, why can't he make something that's not... Because everything is made. The universe, angels, everything we'll talk about, aliens, whatever it's rainbows, are all imperfect. So if he's so good, why can't he make something which is completely perfect? What a good question. And the answer, is everyone up to speed on this? The answer is, it's an amazing answer. The question's not a question. Let me explain it. We talked about, could God create a rock that he can't lift? We said, absolutely not. And he wouldn't want to. He can't do that, because if he could create a rock that he couldn't lift, then that would mean he's deficient. So he can't create a rock. That doesn't mean he's imperfect because he can't make it. This is the famous philosophical circular debate. The answer's like this. He can't make another God because he's got nowhere to put it because he's already there. If he could make another God, that means he could make something which is as perfect as him, which means that he would be deficient because there's something as good as him about. It's an amazing concept. Why can't God make anything perfect? Because if he did, he'd remove his own perfection. Because if he makes something else which is perfect, that means he's not absolutely perfect.
He'd remove his own uniqueness, but why would he remove his own perfection?
Okay, so Elaine is asking, let's say there's two gods, why would that remove perfection? The answer's like this. If you're really completely and utterly perfect, there's no room for anything else. Where would you put anything else as perfect as you? Think about it.
Okay, I'm thinking about that.
You know what? Let it settle in. This stuff is so intense.
Can you clarify that? You're talking about infinite perfection, not infinite size.
No. Excuse me. Ronnie, let me go. It's not... Forget infinite. Perfection means devoid of any possible error, deficiency, problem, issue, negativity, something getting in the way, a niggly point. If I make something, if I make a pencil... that is completely and utterly perfect, utterly perfect, without any deficiency, how can I make that? Only I can be that way. If I'm perfect and nothing else, then if there's any other perfection than me, then I'm not quite as perfect as that, because that's also perfect. I have to be the ultimate perfection. And any other perfection is intolerable, because it diminishes my perfection.
You're talking about God as a physical being.
No, I'm not.
A spiritual.
He's not a spiritual being. God is not spiritual.
God is a being.
God is a being, but he's not spiritual.
But you're measuring the perfection by our standard.
I'm not measuring anything. No, there's no measurement. We can't take a ruler and measure that which is unmeasurable. Mm. There's no ruler. We must also be extremely careful. I think one of the questions Sarah also asked, which touches upon what you're saying, is she said that, well, why did he make anything then? If he's so perfect, why make anything? Yeah. What does he need it for? Yeah. And I explained that the question is not a question. The reason's like this. Everything we make, we need, because we're imperfect. If you make a cake, it's because you're hungry. If you make a car, because you need to get somewhere. There's always a rationale. There's always a need coming from a want. When God wants something, there's no need whatsoever, because God doesn't have any needs. There's no needs. He has no need whatsoever. Because if he's perfect, he can't need anything. If he needs anything, he automatically is imperfect and can't be. All this must be absolutely logically set in. Right? So let's just roll through that one more time. Let's just roll through that one more time. God is not spiritual, God, according to Judaism. God is not physical. God just is. Indeed, when Moses encountered him for the first time at the burning bush, he said, "What's your name?" And he says, "I am that which I am." And Moses said, "I can't go back to Egypt," and says, "I am that which I am came to me and is redeeming you. Give me a name." He goes, "Okay, you can have Yud, K, Vav, K. You can have the Tetragrammaton, the famous four letter name of God, and you can say, that's who did." But he really gave him a very high name to start with. I is what I is. There's nothing you can describe me with. You have absolutely nothing in your life at all. No comparison. No handle, no anything that could possibly compare to me in any way. It can in no way compare to me. All I can tell, again, remember the little 2D guys running around flat, completely flat. And you go down like this and you go, "Hello, 2D people." They wouldn't be able to see you. They wouldn't be able to hear you. They'd maybe experience an energy flux. And if one of them who's extremely enlightened bumped up to you and like felt like a white energy, as you talk about Stephen Hawking saying if you ripped the space-time fabric, a white energy would come out and stop you from getting by. So if they bumped into my face, which is 3D, which they've never experienced because their hands are all 2D, they would say, "What are you?" Now, I can't say, "Well, actually, I live in a place called Manchester, and you don't really know what that means because you don't have any dimension." I just have to say, I am just what I can't really explain it to you because I'm not 2D. Does that all make sense? That's why it's impossible to think of him in any form whatsoever. And he's totally and utterly devoid of any deficiency. He can't do anything wrong, because it would be impossible for him to do that. There's no error he could make. There's nothing he could be unaware of. Sid, where's Dr. Sid? He's not here. Dr. Sid asked a fantastic question at the end. And he said, "How could it be that God knows what you're going to do tomorrow? Do you really have free will?" Which we'll get to in section 2 and 3. The answer is God doesn't exist tomorrow, and he doesn't exist yesterday. Time is something we're bound in. He only exists in the present. It makes you feel very insecure.
Yeah.
I think it should make you feel incredibly safe. No. Let me explain. This is the first time you've heard it, and I've been talking about this for like 2 decades. So let me go through it. Let me just go through it here. It's like this. You're at the red light, and you could jump the red light, right? And God knows, you think. You see, that word is wrong. God doesn't know anything what's going to happen. It's happening now. So if you ask the question, if I put my foot on the accelerator and I jump the red light, does that mean God really knows whether or not I'm going to jump the red light before I do it? All these things are putting human problems onto God and saying, well, God doesn't know what's going to happen. Sorry?
No, that's okay.
God doesn't yet know what's going to happen. And once I do it, then he'll know. So really, it doesn't work like that at all. God is experiencing everything immediately, which means he's with Adam in the Garden of Eden now. He's redeeming the whole world with the Messiah. He's answering your great-grandparents' prayers. He's at your birth. He's answering your great-grandchildren's prayers right now because they're all putting it in right now. And all the choices they're making are immediate, right now. And that's not a problem for him because it's an infinite, non-corporeal, completely perfect being. And isn't limited by space, time, dimension, or anything like that. We're limited by space. We're limited by time. We experience things in the past. In fact, as I said to someone, we never experience the future. We never experience the present. We only live in the past. Because everything you've ever experienced was at least a millisecond ago. So you've never had anything in the present, ever in your life. You never will. In fact, if you think about it, present doesn't exist. It's a micro-nanosecond going into the future. And you certainly don't know the future, because if you did, you would be telling me the lottery numbers. And you didn't. So you do because you don't know. So you've never experienced anything in the future. You'll never experience anything in the present. You only live in the past. You can't take that and say, well, if God is only living in the past as well, how does it? You can't ask those questions. You can't take your limitation saying, well, if I always need to make things because I have wants and needs, well, if God's making something, he must have needs too. Who says? Don't do that. Throughout this entire course, don't take your issues and transplant them onto God saying, well, if I need to do that, God must need to do that. So if God needs to do that and he can't do that, that's all the way he's going to end up in a pickle. Okay? That's pretty much a recap of pretty much everything, I think, wasn't it? We did do a few other things as well, which are really interesting, but we don't have time for that. I'm now going to continue reading. Oh, I have to tell you about cosmic background microwave radiation.
I was worried about that.
And so you should be. You haven't heard it yet. All right. You put your radio in your car and you tune it in between channels and you get... Do you know what that is, that white noise? Static. That static noise. What is that?
Universe.
It's the universe. In fact, it's not an echo. It is actually the sound of the Big Bang happening. That's being caught on radio waves because it exudes radio magnetism, basically. Electromagnetic magnetism, basically. That's what's going on. Your radio's picking it up and the sound is actually the sound of a huge explosion. If you're really clever and you know how to do echolocation and sonographs, which is what the military do, if you hear a reflection of something, you can figure out where that thing came from, right? Like that's how radar works, that's how submarines ping things. Echolocation. So if you're really clever, you can figure out where the item's coming from. And they have! Those clever scientists in rooms somewhere with calculators and things. And they've said like this. Now, listen to this. This is great. If a street magician came up and asked you whether or not you'd pay 10 quid to see this, just ask yourself whether or not you'd pay 10 quid. Can you see everything in this room? Everything. All the pages in all those books. The wood panelling. All the stitches. Every single little piece of everything. All the plastic things here with the donations and all the Illumi Nishmas candles. Every single thing in this room. Imagine I said I'm going to pop a balloon and every single thing in this room is going to pop out exactly as it is in this room in the car park for a tenner. So I have a bit of a whip round. Would you pay a tenner to see that? Yeah. I'd pay a tenner to see. I would pay a tenner to see. I'd pay a tenner to see myself do that. So I take a balloon and go, oh, is everyone ready? It's going to be big. Okay. Boom. And the entire room with everything in it, all this just pops up in the car park. And I'm talking everything. All the little scratches and dents and everything is all there. And you're like, now that was worth £10. I'll see that again. If you did that again, I'll pay you 15. That's this room, okay? Imagine I could do that with Reading. All of Reading. All the houses. It's a town. It's a town just outside of London. For those individuals who don't know what Reading is. For those individuals, I'm going to have to change my examples. I will do that with Oxford. It really doesn't matter, Mrs. Goodman. I really don't. It doesn't matter. Any town in the world. But I'm talking everything. Every piece of paving, every piece of pavement, every brick in every building, all the computers and all the wires and everything just go... And it's just like, you'll be like, now that's worth 50 quid. That's a big town. Scientists now say that the entire universe, as we know it, with all matter, with all energy, with all the laws of the universe, the speed of light, gravity, magnetism, how atoms bond with each other, everything popped out of a speck that would be microscopic to us, that means you could only see it with a microscope, in a fraction of one Earth second, to something 50 billion light years wide. Which means if you got in a car that was travelling at the speed of light, it would take you 50 billion years to get from one end to the other, in an instant, with everything in it. And the reason they know that is because if you work out the echo from the Big Bang that you hear in the radio, it goes down to one infinitesimally small spot like that. Then it went boop into the universe with the sun and comets and nebula and all the laws of everything that everything happened. Just all popped up, I don't know what. To something so massively enormous, as my daughter would say, jinkombongous, so utterly ginormous, with everything in it, and it is now constantly expanding at a uniform rate, like it inflating a balloon. And it's all there, absolutely perfectly. Isn't that worth 50 quid, if you could see that happen? It's bigger than Reading. A lot bigger than Reading. But that's what they say. Now, we would call that a creative act. Oh, sorry. This material would refer to that as a creative act. It's not for me to tell you what you would call anything. Okay? Why am I telling you this? Because of what we're about to read next. Phew, we're actually going to go forward. We're on page 31. And we are at the third indent down, which is the second indent of point two. Is everybody on the page? Are we all together?
Mm-hmm. Have you got a spare ball?
I don't. Does everyone at least have a text to look into? Okay. Now, how do you know all this? Says the Ramchal, and he's bringing this from all sources because we said he's actually only gathering data together across the lexicon of Jewish learning. These things, about everything that we've discussed, are known by tradition from the patriarchs and the prophets. We'll discuss what a patriarch is, and we'll discuss what prophets are. Almost certainly not what you think. Most people do not know what prophecy actually is. It's not a communication from God. We'll talk about that. Okay? With the revelation at Sinai, now, who was it that asked me what happened at Sinai? I think it was Andy. And Andy is not here either.
Well,
I am trying, though.
Question and they don't come back.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. They ask a question, I write it down, I've got a thing, and they're not here. Andy, if you're listening, here we are. These, with the revelation at Sinai, all Israel perceived them, this piece of data, and gained a clear grasp of their true nature. And they did that through prophecy. All 3 million people that were standing at the foot of Mount Sinai all received a prophetical revelation, which we'll talk about later. There were 603,550 men between the ages of 20 and 60. Their wives, their children, all their families, and a whole load of Gentiles that came out with them at the time. They then taught them this data that I'm telling you to their children, generation after generation, until this very day. Moses has thus commanded in Devarim, which is Deuteronomy, chapter 4, verse 9, you shall not forget the things that you saw with your own eyes, and you shall make them known to your children and your children's children. This, by the way, Rabbi Lawrence Kellerman uses along with the Khazari principle to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that Judaism is extremely unique in its tradition, in the fact that there is no one person that got it, and he translates it. Every single man, woman and child all got this.
The Rambam.
No, the Khazari.
The Rambam also.
The Rambam says something.
Yeah.
He says he doesn't utilise that to justify the religion as being true, but Rabbi Lawrence Kellerman has an awesome, awesome discourse about this, explaining how Judaism must be true because we're the only religion that could get away with saying such an incredibly intense statement, which would be absurd unless it happened. Okay. Now, this is why I told you about cosmic background microwave radiation. These concepts can also be logically verified by demonstrable proofs. Their veracity can be demonstrated from what we observe in nature and its phenomena, which is an incredibly designed system. Through such scientific disciplines as physics and astronomy, remember he wrote this in 1736-ish, certain basic principles can be derived, and on the basis of these, clear evidence for these concepts deduced. We will not occupy ourselves with this, however. This is not a science text, but we'll rather set forth the well-known basic principles handed down by tradition. He's now telling you, I am not going to be giving you algorithms and scientific equations. You want to do that, but buck a shot in your own time. But it's not going to be as good as what I'm telling you. These we will present in an authentic framework, arranged in a comprehensive manner. Point three. Wow, we are chugging through this. It is also necessary to know. Notice he uses know, not the word believe. That God's existence is imperative. It is absolutely impossible that he should cease to exist. Because if he did, he wouldn't be perfect. You can't be perfect and not be here. Now, point four is an extension of point three. Then we're going to stop and we're going to come back to the blue orange. It is furthermore necessary to know that God's existence... Now, listen, this is really key, people. His existence doesn't depend on anything else at all. His existence is intrinsically imperative. The dependency that God does have, he has one dependency, according to Jewish thought, that he must exist. That's his dependency. He's dependent upon himself. Now, this is unlike the blue orange. The blue orange is totally dependent upon you. It cannot exist. Do you know what I'm talking about when I talk about the blue orange, Dovey?
Yeah. I was here.
You were here for that. The blue orange. You don't know about the blue orange. No. Okay, it's a download section. It's a download on the foot.
Okay, it's fine.
Carry on. I just really want to know about the blue orange. Anyway, the blue orange is absolutely 100% dependent upon you. The second you stop thinking about it, blue orange disappears, which means you have a higher level of independence than the blue orange, because the blue orange needs you to exist and you don't need it to exist. You're perfectly fine if you never would have thought about a blue orange. Point five. It is likewise necessary to know that God is absolutely simple. I think this is a question Ronnie asked in the very first session. Having no parts to him. We're going to discuss that. At the same time, all types of perfection are present in him, contained in his being, without being separate parts of it. We're going to discuss, I think we discussed that when God speaks, he doesn't speak with a mouth. The reason for that would be a great level of imperfection, because my mouth needs a lung, and the lung has to push air up through my throat, and I have to do all kinds of shaping things with my vocal cords, my mouth and my teeth all make sense and stuff like that. And if I didn't have every single system all perfectly, I couldn't be able to speak. God doesn't have parts, because those parts need each other. My mouth needs my lungs, and my lungs need my heart, and my heart needs my blood, and my blood needs my muscles, and my muscles need my skeleton needs my nerves. And if anything is wrong anywhere, it doesn't work, right? So far, so good. Everybody with me? We can try to understand this by observing that the human mind, has many different faculties. Each one with its own area of activity. For example, memory is one domain, desire another, and imagination, which we're going to talk about a lot in section three, another. And none of these faculties impinge on the other. Memory, for example, has its own domain, as does desire, and desire does not penetrate the domain of memory. Nor does memory enter the actual domain of desire. You could, of course, think of two things like that, but it is not one over the other in the actual domain of the psyche itself. The same is true of all the mind's faculties. The human mind can therefore be said to have structure. We know there's a limbic system, an occipital lobe, a cerebral cortex, and those different parts of the brain have different functions. There's bits to it. Therefore, it isn't simple. It's structured. Anything with structure isn't simple. God, however, doesn't require separate domains for each of these powers. In fact, he does possess these powers which, in man, would be different from one another, But for God, we can say, does desire. He is wise. He is capable. And is perfect in every conceivable way. But he's not compartmentalized. That's the key. He doesn't have compartments, okay? On the other hand, God is... I'm just going to get into this material, then we'll talk about it. God is actually one. This phenomena being present in, and I've underlined the word in him, without being separate parts of him. He doesn't have... So the Trinity concept in Christianity of the Father, the Ghost, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, that is absolutely an anathema to Judaism. God can't have component parts. Because if he does, that means each individual component part is somehow intrinsically imperfect. Which means the subcomponents need each other, which means the whole must be imperfect because it has structure and is therefore not simple. So that is an absolute anathema to Jewish thought. All types of perfection exist in God, not as phenomena which are separable from his absolute oneness. It isn't as if he's got a cricket bat and is very, 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 very good at cricket. He's just absolutely able in every way intrinsically. And it is impossible that God not possess every possible perfection. Because if he did, he'd be imperfect. Admittedly, thank goodness he's going to say this, this is something far beyond the grasp of our understanding and imagination. Because the second we think about it, we're utilising synapses in our brain, which is already an imperfect system. The very way that we think about things is flawed. Because it's finite. Everything we do when we think about things, we aren't perfect beings. So the second we try to clothe something with a concept, it's automatically a failure when trying to grasp these ideas. Our intellect and imagination are only capable of grasping things bound by the natural limitations created by God. Since these are the only things that our senses can detect and convey to our minds, we're incapable of conceiving these different qualities as a simple essence, since among created things, they're always different, totally separate, structured concepts. I'm obviously adding in a couple of words there, just to clarify. All right, we began our discussion, however, is everyone with me on the same page, yeah? We began our discussion, however, by acknowledging that God's true nature is beyond comprehension. No inference can be drawn to the Creator from what we see among created things, that would automatically be a failure. The nature and essence of the two are not the same at all, and it is therefore impossible to draw any parallel between them whatsoever. This, however, is also among the things that we know from the tradition discussed earlier. It can also be verified from the laws and principle of nature that it is impossible that some being not exist unbound by the laws and limitations of nature. Do you have highlighters or pencils with you here? I'm going to need you to make a note in a second. This being must furthermore be divorced from all addition. You can't make another one of it. Structure. He doesn't have bits. Relationship. He can't have to have someone else so he can be whole. Comparison. There's no one else you can say, he's like that. Or any other quality that exists in created things. Finally, and I've underlined this so you can highlight this. This being must be the true cause of everything that exists and happens. Unless all this is true, the existence and continuance of things, as we know them, would be utterly impossible. That's a pretty heavy piece of data, isn't it? Heavy? Would you say that's heavy? I'd say that's heavy. The last thing he's going to do, I'm going to do a little bit of maths at the end here on point six. He's going to say, by the way, if you turn over, that's the end of this. We will not be coming back to discuss God himself. That's the end of it. There's nothing more to talk about him. There's nothing more to say. There is no more to say. If you have questions about it, I'm happy to knock them out now. But there's nothing more we could ever discuss about him. There's just nothing to say. Among the things that it is also necessary to know is that God must be absolutely one. Brett, this is what Elaine was touching upon about the concept of unity. It is impossible that there exist more than one being whose existence is intrinsically imperative. Because who's thinking who up? That means whoever's thinking the other one up is more important. The buck's got to stop somewhere, right? Only one being can possibly exist with this necessarily perfect essence, because if anyone else did, it wouldn't be perfect. And therefore, the only reason all other things have the possibility of existence is that this being called God wills them to exist. We'll ask why in a second. What about evil? Did someone just say, what about evil? God had to think that up. We'll talk about why he had to bring that into being. All other things, therefore, depend on him and don't have intrinsic existence, just like the blue orange. So far, so good. Is everyone with me? Dovey, are you with me? Are you with me, Dovey?
Why are you picking on me?
I don't know. You know what? Because I am. I'll pick on other people as well. Don't worry about it. We therefore see that there are six basic principles involved in our understanding of God. Now, this is really important, guys. We're going to actually whittle this down. There are six things only that we can possibly say about him. And this is it. There is nothing extra you can add to the list. And I would argue there's actually quite a few you could take away. Number one is the fact that he exists. The fact of existence must be. That's all we can say about God. Number one. Number two, that he's perfect. He's devoid of every conceivable indeficiency. Number three, the necessity of existence. He's got to exist. You can't have, he couldn't not be, because part of his perfection is he has to exist. If you're perfect, you've actually got to exist. So you've got to be there. His absolute independence. Could you just jump to page 273? 273, yeah, we covered a lot of ground tonight, didn't we? Well, we've got to 273. If you look at the very top line of page 273, which is actually when we talk about the Shema, it says everything else exists only because God desires it and wills that it exist. And that is a definition of absolute independence. So you could make a mark there, cross-reference with page 35 if you like. So that's number four. Number five is, as Elaine was talking about, we're going to get now, to simplicity. He's simple, he has no structure, he has no subcomponents, he has no parts, he doesn't have feet, he doesn't need a ginormous pair of shoes. And his unity. He's absolutely unified. He doesn't have bits in him that mean that he's got to have him and someone else and another bit as well. Comes back to the Trinity concept. Absolutely not. So these are the six things we know, and no more ever. You'll never know any more about him. Well, let's start to actually mathematically cancel this out. In this list of six things, are there anything in here that we could do without because something in there already contains it? Can we start to whittle this off and say, you know what? This list of six, really, we could whittle down to five, or maybe four, or maybe three, or maybe two, because the ideas are contained within the other ideas. Do you hear what I'm saying? Yeah. Okay, people. Sorry? Yeah, okay, fine. Richard, yeah. I'm picking on you.
Which Richard?
Oh, you, Richard, as well. Richard at the back and Richard in the middle. Those are your new names. Richard at the back and Richard in the middle. I was picking on Dobby and now I'm picking at Richard in the back. Richard in the back. Richard in the middle, I'll get to you later. Richard in the back. Is there anything you could see here which could possibly fit in another one of these headings? Oh, very good. Can you just say that out louder?
His unity in his perfection.
So which is the primary, which is the secondary?
The primary is his perfection.
The primary would be his perfection. Why would unity be secondary to that?
Because unity is implied by perfection.
Possibly. Would it not be implied by simplicity? Yeah. If you're unified, you're therefore simple. He can't be complex. He can't be. Now, I don't mean complex as in like our complexes. He can't have any complexity whatsoever. There's nothing to him. He just is. Someone asked me after I've went through the whole of the book with him, and he said to me, he just almost grabbed me by my lapels and says, "Well, what is he then?" We went through like 2 years together. What is he? He said to me just before he went to shul on Rosh Hashanah. He says, "You've changed my life." I said, "Is that a good thing or a bad thing?" He said, "I'm not sure." So I said, "Oh, I felt very bad." I said, "What's the problem?" He said, "I'm about to go to shul on Rosh Hashanah, and I know that I'm meant to be standing in front of God, right? But what am I standing in front of?" I kind of thought of him in a very different way before you started telling me all this stuff. So he says, "What do you think of? How do you envisage God?" Now, if you go to cartoons or the Sistine Chapel ceiling, God is usually envisioned by people as an older gentleman with long hair and a beard and in a white cloak that goes around creating things. It's so utterly impossible based on what we're talking about. It's so ridiculously completely banal. So he said, well, what is he then? What do you think? What is that? So this is my, but now, this is, remember I told you, I'm not going to tell you what I think. I'm only going to tell you what the data said. I'm not going to break the rule and I can tell you what I think, but it is work in progress and I'm not saying it's accurate. So this is stuff that you can actually just throw in the bin. You just throw it in the bin and go, that's very nice, and delete it, okay? It's the only time so far in these three sessions I've actually said something to you out of my own mind that is something I've thought about rather than what has been presented to me. Here we go. Happy to have people sharpen this and tell me that I'm wrong or that it's rubbish, which is fine. If you add it all up, I reckon this thing is an infinite consciousness. It's just a mind. It's a psyche which has no parts to it. It doesn't have areas of hate and love or anything like that. It just is. It's just an infinite consciousness, an infinite life force. It just is. There's nothing else to it. Now, I'm willing for people to shut that down because it's work in progress. And I've only been thinking about that for several months. I've been looking it up and stuff like that. But it's something, it's a working thing that you can think about. He can't have anything else. He can't be anything else.
In whose consciousness is he?
He's not in anyone's consciousness. He just is. Is he in someone else's consciousness? I'm great because this is my idea and I'm already getting flack. I'm so glad I'm bringing it out.
No, that's the point.
No, I was just
going to
say, if it's just a general, like, if you think of him in terms of that with no hate, no love.
No, he's got hate and love, but they're not components which have bits that they're boxes that they fit in. In our mind, we've got schema. I think Dr. Sid talked about the guy who was in the PET scanner and they asked him about vegetables and parts of his mind and then they asked him about fruit and other parts of his mind. So you could say there's parts of the brain that think about vegetables and there's parts of the mind that think about fruit. Bizarrely, right? That means when we've experienced... How do we know the difference? How do you know an aubergine is not a fruit? I mean, who's really to say? So but we grow up knowing that tomatoes are one thing and strawberries are another. Although, really, halakhically, they're both Odoma. But we'll go... That's a bad example. Okay, that's a bad example. I'm allowed to give bad examples here and there. Work with me, people.
Stick with carrots.
Carrots and grapes. Now, that means that we think about carrots and grapes as separate things. God, obviously, is completely unaware of what love is and he's completely aware of what hatred is. But it's not as if they're in separate domains in his consciousness. His consciousness is not human consciousness, not like an unbound human consciousness which is left to kind of like wobble about. No, it's completely different from that. It's unbound, but he doesn't have a body. Because no body could contain such a thing. Not a multi-dimensional, pan-dimensional body. Because the second you have a body, you have an end to something. If you have an arm, it's got to stop somewhere. So he can't have any body whatsoever. Which is one of the 13 principles of faith. That God can't have any semblance of physicality. What if he can't even be imagined to have any semblance? It's just impossible. You've got a question, David.
Yes,
you've got a question.
Saying, but aren't we, in fact, in our prayers, all the time putting human qualities on?
There's anthropomorphism, which is attributing human qualities to the Creator specifically, if you look at it in Oxford Dictionary. It's right throughout the Torah.
That's for us.
You know what, people? I'm so glad that it's bringing up such a tool. However, due to my limited imperfections, I can actually only hear one thing at a time. So I need to answer, because David asked first and first come, first served. And that's just a limited thing that I have to do. David, it's like this. Biyad Roma, Biyad Gadola, with an outstretched arm, with a mighty hand. That doesn't mean God has a hand. That means his interface system with the physical world uses something which you would understand as a hand. The interface unit, we're going to be talking about interface systems, how God actually gets involved with the physical world. That could be said to be what you would understand as an outstretched arm. Not that his arm is outstretched, because if it was, where would it be before that?
Limitation.
They'd be withdrawn in him. What it means, it would be here, wouldn't be there, which means he can't be there. Which is what's going on. It's obviously impossible in his essence. Which is, by the way, if you turn over, that's it for God. There's no more to discuss. There's no more to discuss about him. All we can discuss about him from here on in. Ooh, I'm sorry. Did I wake him up? All that we can discuss about this from here on in is an interface. How God deals with, reacts to, talks to, gets involved, makes, creates, makes things which are abstract into concretized pieces of physicality which we can interface with, makes the whole world with laws of gravity and light and photons and packages and chemicals and molecules and things like that. How he does that? We talked about him. So when it says that, you know, that his eyes see from one end of the world to the other, that doesn't actually mean his eyes, because I don't have eyes. It means that his perceptive ability, and what he uses for that is it can see, can do that.
I like
tough crowd tonight, hey? Tough crowd tonight. I actually like one of the things you've said tonight. Well, that's great, Mrs. Goodman.
Yeah, not
Mrs.
Goodman.
Oh, sorry, Ms. Goodman.
No. But I like that your concept of a two-dimensional being and us as three-dimensional, because really us to God is then three-dimensional to multi-dimensional.
He's not multi-dimensional.
Multi-dimensional.
There's no extremely. He isn't bound by any dimension at all.
But beyond ours.
Something
that's hugely different.
Though.
Sorry?
It's something so beyond
comprehension. That's it. Just like a 2D being wouldn't be able to experience a 3D being.
Yes.
A 3D being wouldn't be able to experience a 4D.
No.
A 7D certainly wouldn't be able to be perceived. But he created the concept of dimension. Which means he can't be bound by it. Because if he was, he'd be imperfect. That means I create an egg, and that means I must be in it now. What are you talking about? If you create it, you can't be in it. You've got to make it from the outside. I can't. Because I make eggs out of chocolate, does not mean that I'm now inside an egg.
Sorry, we went to eggs.
The concept is, if you make a car, you can't say, I'm inside. I have to be able to be a master of it. If you make time, you make space, you make dimension, you make everything, that means you're not bound by it. You are making it. You have mastery over that thing. You can't say, well, I'm actually now in it now. It just doesn't work like that. So far, so good? Tough crowd. So fine. Simplicity and unity absorb each other. Richard in the middle, I'm coming to you soon, so keep sharp. If he's simple, Richard in the middle, don't let go of this. If he's simple, he of course must be unity. Unity must be involved in his simplicity. So we can knock unity out, cancel out a secondary, and simplicity is primary versus unity. So we've already deleted one of these six. Are there anything else which could fit into any other? Richard in the middle.
Well, basically, you could knock them all out apart from the top one.
The fact of his existence? Let's say he exists, but he's got components.
But we...
I think the one that trumps it all is perfection.
Okay, hands up for those that think the most important is the fact of his existence. Richard in the middle and... Me. Okay, hands up all those who think perfection is the most important. Oh, there's a lot of people here putting up their hands. The answer is like this. Oh, that's such a good question. Sumus who first asked, pretty great. Okay, that's a question I can't do with right in a second. Just let me know. It's Aria Kaplan that whittles them down. Aria Kaplan whittles them down in other works. And he's a mathematician. The answer is like this. The most important next bit is perfection. Let me explain for why. The fact that he exists, the fact that he must necessarily exist, and the fact that he's independent, that he doesn't need anyone else or an atmosphere to breathe, is part of his perfection. Because a perfection is a complete lack of any deficiency whatsoever. You can't be perfect if you aren't here. You can't be perfect if you need to breathe oxygen. You can't be perfect if you have to say that I could for a moment step outside or commit suicide. You just can't do that. Because there can be no deficiency in you if you're perfect. Which means there are only two things we know about God. And this we're going to leave it tonight. There are only two things we know about God. And that's it. Then we close the book on God for the entire Jewish philosophy course. There's one little facet of Jewish philosophy. The answer is number one. That this being called God that we have in Judaism, according to Jewish thought, is number one, completely perfect, which means he's devoid of any conceivable deficiency. That knocks out almost everything except for his unity. The next thing that we have is that he is totally simple. There are no, now it could be that he was perfect with component parts. All of his component parts are perfect. Not so. Really, he's completely simple. You could argue that really, if true perfection is devoid of any deficiency, even having to have component parts is an imperfection. So I hold that maybe you could say everything boils down, even its simplicity, to its perfection. Bottom line, if someone asks you, according to Judaism, what is the Jewish concept of God, you would say, if you wanted to be in line with Jewish sources, not because it's what you could say, I don't necessarily believe this, but I went to a Jewish philosophy course at this particular synagogue, however many days or years it was ago, and this is what we concluded. Number one, Judaism believes that this being is the creator, and this being is completely perfect, which means it, whatever it is devoid of any possible deficiency whatsoever. That is all Judaism knows about it. Nothing more can be discussed or expressed or explained, because the human mind simply is a fallible tool to be able to do that. You can't use your mind to be able to think anything more than that. A simple creator, a perfect creator. Paul.
But doesn't God have some sort of deficiencies, not deficiencies, but doesn't he have needs? Because doesn't God want to have like relationship with human beings?
Do you hear this? Do you hear what Paul's saying? Paul is saying, look, if we're around and he's made us, this is the question Sarah asked. Doesn't he have a need? Now listen to these needs that you would have. Let's pretend that I'm God for a second.
You are, in a way.
Such a sweet guy, Paul. That's why he's saying, that's why I like him so very much. I'm bored. I'm depressed. I have low self-confidence. There's nothing in the entire universe but me. Nothing. There's just me. And there's nothing else. Nothing. It's just me. I'm all alone. All these concepts that I'm saying to you are human deficiencies. God doesn't get bored. He doesn't have a low self-esteem. He doesn't require companionship. He doesn't need fulfillment with anything. His own existence is his fulfillment. He doesn't need you. If you all disappeared, he wouldn't be hurt. He wouldn't be damaged. He wouldn't be incomplete. There's nothing you can do to hurt, damage, deicide, kill. It's like the blue orange in your dream going, I know that I am only a figment of Paul's imagination. So I will take out a knife, which of course Paul is also dreaming up, and I will stab him and I will kill him. He's in your mind. It can't hurt. It's impossible to damage you. There's no need you have for the blue orange. We have a need for blue orange because we're bored and we could be thinking about the football. So we think about the blue orange instead. He has no need for us at all. And if we all disappeared, he would be no less perfect than he is should we be here. The question that we answered to Sarah last week was that he wanted us. The question that we had with that then was, if he wanted us, why would he want us? Because every want that we have, any want we have ever experienced in our lives, anything. I thought about something last week. Someone said, well, what about if you paint a picture? An artist paints a picture. He wants to paint a picture. He doesn't need the picture. The answer is yes, he does. To express his creative urges. I'm a musician. I need to play the guitar, man. I just need it. It's part of what I do. It isn't as if I'm doing it just as a flowery. Art is possibly the highest thing in humanity of something which is intrinsically unnecessary. In fact, if something is utilisable or functional, it can't be art. Art can only be truly art if it's unfunctional and unusable in any other way except for what it is. You can have things which are a car, which is very artistic, but it can never be art. Art is only what it is. But even that was a necessity of the human impulse. a necessary expression of what humans are. God has no needs. So when he wants something, he wants it not because he has a need as a prerequisite. He wants it because he wants it. Why does God want us? It's an impossible question to answer. Because the second we start thinking about it, we're always thinking about it wrong. Whatever concepts that we would think about are intrinsically flawed. He wants us. He doesn't need us. He wants us. But clearly, if we weren't here, there's no lack. Not in him, only for us. He wants the blue-orange. If he didn't want it, it wouldn't be there. The blue-orange needs him, but he doesn't need the blue-orange.
What about the concept of God and love? And, you know, sort of God sort of wanting to have a relationship and, you know, and love for his people, you know.
Indeed, there are many places in Torah, Nevi'im and Kesuvim which discuss God's intense love. If you read the Song of Songs, it's nothing short of a passionate love between God and his people. But that love is not like human love, which is all based upon needs. All human love is based upon needs, one way or another. And as supernal as the greatest two human beings that have loved each other in the most incredibly altruistic way, if that's even possible for a human being, because all altruism is questionable really for humans, in that way, it's always based upon some kind of need, a desire or drive which requires checking. I'm lonely, so I'll find companionship. I'll give of myself to that person selflessly as much as I can in order to fulfill my own needs, to be able to give to someone else. Because if I don't, I'll feel unfulfilled. He doesn't have any of that. There are no needs at all. Because he's simply perfect. Which means he can't have a need. What's really going to bake your cake later is if he doesn't have any imperfection, how can he make a choice? Have you thought about that? Have you ever thought about that? God can't choose like we can. For lunch, I can have a bagel, smoked salmon, and cream cheese. Or a BLT. I could. No, you wouldn't know. How would you know? I'm doing it in secret. How would you know? Could I have a BLT? No problem. That's a choice between good and bad, according to the Judaic law. He doesn't have a choice between good and bad. How could he possibly have bad? He doesn't have needs.
I think choice is an imperfection as well.
Excellent. Choice itself is an imperfection, only based on a deficiency. If you really knew the outcome, brilliant. If you really knew the outcome, there'd be no choice. If you really knew the outcome, you wouldn't have a choice, would you? We need choice because we need that. We'll talk about why we have choice. He has no needs at all. Yes, he loves us. The Rambam says, it's very difficult to say these words. The Rambam says you should love Hashem like a man that is in infatuated with a woman, that if he isn't with her, he'd die. That's the Jewish religion. If he doesn't have her, he's going to die. That's the feeling of rapture you should have with the Creator. Could you believe the Rambam said those words? But that's the feeling of love you should express to create. That's the feeling of love, as it were, that we can understand that he has for you. But not that he'd be damaged if he didn't have you. We know what it's like that if we don't have something, we feel a lack. He can't. He knows what we would feel like, but he can't experience that. Because he can't experience lack. It's an amazing concept.
So he can't feel what we can feel.
He knows exactly what we're feeling, but he cannot feel it himself in his essence. How could he? He's perfect. Which means we are completely separate. Now, we've come to a time at this particular session where it's for me to say, anyone that wants to go, just feel absolutely free to do so. We are not chaining you down with a ball and chain. I would love to leave this year, but there's a 50-ton way. It isn't like that. That would be a great way, actually, Dove, if we could organise that we'd probably get quite a lot more people staying in the ship longer. But it probably is illegal But if anyone wants to go, just go. If anyone wants to stay, you're welcome to stay. I'm happy to stay as long as Dove isn't rocking the baby back and forth. It's all okay. Baby's sleeping. It's all good for another 10, 15 minutes. But if you say, listen, oh my gosh, my snooker table's arriving. I've got to be there because they're putting the slate in. Then, of course, you can go. But these topics, you understand what we're touching upon here? We're touching upon the very edge of what can be touched upon. Richard in the middle, how do you feel about that?
Yeah. Can I just ask you to make an observation?
Of course! You can make an observation, I'm quite. You can make it.
This is all fantastic.
Is it?
Stuff.
Yeah. Oh, wow, we've got one positive thing. I like one thing you've said. The rest of it's a load of rubbish, it is.
The overriding concern I always have is this all a human attempt to feel comfortable?
Oh, what a brilliant... Is it opium for the masses?
So that...
Richard in the middle, let me answer your question. We're making this up to feel good. Because really we're nothing. We're just evolved pieces of protoplasm which really just have this urge to feel religious because that's how we've developed from amoebas. And this is what human beings do, right? Human beings do it. Dogs don't do it. We do it. And we're just... Think about it, Richard! The entire universe popped out of nothing in an instant... being 50 billion years wide with rules, and those rules aren't just in the sun, they're in your genetic structure. The cells in your body contain the code for everything else in your body. Death is put in genetically called apoptosis. There's a gene that comes in, wanders around the other genes and says stop and die, and it happens in a perfect wave genetically, which means it must have been added to the system. Because intrinsically we should not die. A cell is a perfect machine that has no reason to die. Energy in, output out. Adenosine triphosphate keeps chunking out the mitochondria. Energy comes out and you're rocking and rolling for life. Nothing should kill it unless there's trauma, radiation, something that will prevent its nutrients and necrosis. It should just carry on forever. What makes it just get old and die? A gene that says get old and die. If you could block that gene, you'd be immortal. And the genes are all ruled. Maths is ruled. Everything is ruled. You see this? Do you know what this was? 50 minutes ago, it was a tree. I chopped it down and just fell into this. How convenient. Would you believe such nonsense? I'll tell you what feeling comfortable is about. Let me tell you, Richard in the middle, what feeling comfortable is about. Lady Goodman,
Karen.
I can't say anything because Karen said like this. That makes me feel uncomfortable. Let me tell you why we could believe that this Ständer was a tree that just fell down and just happened to fall into all these very useful bits. Because that makes us feel comfortable. Do you know why? Because we feel uncomfortable about the fact that every single thing in the universe is obeying immutable laws, except for us. Use a microscope and look at small things. Perfectly ordered. Use a telescope. Just recently an amazing thing happened. They shot a satellite onto a comet. How could they do that? Unless everything was obeying perfect rules you could work with. If it was all random, it would be impossible. Telescopes and microscopes, perfect order. Your life, complete chaos. The chaos only exists as an illusion in your perception, but not when you look out of your perception or reality. The sun doesn't look like chaos. Cells don't look like chaos. Atoms now, which can be photographed by electron microscopes, look incredibly ordered. Everything's obeying immutable rules. Mm-hmm. We aren't, because I could have had that BLT for lunch. That makes us feel very uncomfortable. Because if light itself is obeying a mutable rule, and fuel burns in my engine at a very calculable rate, and the sun takes 8 minutes to shoot its photons to Earth, exactly. Everything's under control. But what about me? That makes me feel terribly uncomfortable. Better I just think I'm an evolved duck. And I can just do what I want, And because monkeys aren't put in jail for stealing bananas, I can have my BLT, right? That makes us feel comfortable. It isn't that question that does religion make us feel comfortable. Judaism gives us only responsibility. No rights. There are no rights. There's only responsibilities to be fulfilled by others for you and you for others. I know my rights. What rights? You mean I have responsibility to fulfill what you want me to do? That makes us feel terribly uncomfortable. We'll make up intelligence insulting concepts in order to make ourselves feel comfortable. That's where comfort comes in. If you want to believe that God will have a son and kill him so you can just do whatever you want, that'll make you feel very comfortable. Notice Judaism believes that we could have a son, and if need be, we'd sacrifice him for you. If need be. Because we don't put God in the middle of our equation. All other religions do. I'll sin, I'll go and tell someone about it, and I'm good. Who's whose servant here? God's fulfilling my needs. I want to go win a war. I get a goat, slaughter a goat, pour it out on the altar. Now that I've paid you this goat, I ask you for power in my war tomorrow. So who's who? You just bought this god with a goat. Who's serving who here? I want, in the name of the Quran, put down your weapons. In the name of the Quran, pick up your weapons. Which means I do what I want, and God will put an endorsement on it. Whatever I want. That makes us feel very comfortable. You're right, religion is the opium of the masses. This isn't religion. This is a statement of what is. Very different. Judaism isn't a religion. It's a way of understanding a universal reality and having a love relationship with an infinite consciousness. But you haven't heard that before. Judaism isn't a religion. It's about understanding what is a universal truth and having what amounts to a loving, a relationship of intense love, rapture that if you feel as if you couldn't have it, you'd die, with an infinite consciousness. That's what to put on the Gallup poll if somebody stops in a yellow finger. Well, just a little thing. Could you tell us what Judaism means to you? Yes, Judaism means to me understand the universal truths and having a love affair with an infinite creator. Thank you very much. That's what it is. There's no more to it. Everything else is detail, Richard, in the middle. Everything else is detail. Now, that should make you feel comfortable. That should make you feel real and give you an intense, dutiful sense of responsibility to manifest it. Other religions are into... There's a religion of a man that went into a forest, found a pair of magic goggles, and with the magic goggles was able to translate what he believed to be the lost set of the Ten Commandments. And on that set of Ten Commandments, which you could only read with the magic goggles, it meant that he could go back and marry however many women he wanted. Interesting. And only men he say can get married. And he walked back in town and said, an angel appeared to me.
Which religion is it?
Mormonism.
Oh, right, yeah.
What is the religion based on? I want the religion or God will give me my desires. Judaism is far from that one. Because it ain't a religion. You went to a shir tonight with a rabbi. They said to you, Judaism isn't a religion. The more you understand that, the better you got it.
I wasn't questioning Judaism.
No, you were questioning... No, you were. You were really saying, do we make this all up to feel comfy?
What I was saying was, I believe there is this infinite being. I believe that without... Nothing makes sense without it. But all I'm questioning is that belief something that the human being has to have, needs? Do you see where I'm coming from?
It's a very good question. Is the concept of belief a prerequisite necessity in being a human being, Is that your question?
Because without that, nothing makes sense. So therefore, we've got to have that. And is that something that we've created or has been created?
We've not created anything about us, but the choices we make. That's it. That's all you've got in life. You've got nothing else about apart from the choices you make, if you think about it really carefully.
Because it's faith, ultimately.
It's not. No, it isn't. I explained that knowing and belief, when Kobe asked that question, when I spoke to Kobe about the phone number, you said, with respect, I'm really working. We're all friends here. I'm going to say something to you, Richard, in the middle. You say you believe that this creator's there. What kind of belief is that? Is that belief one, where you don't really know how it goes, but you believe it anyway? Is that belief two, that you've worked at it so thoroughly that you've actually got it down?
I just can't. Without it, nothing makes sense. Why? I can't tell
you. So it's a bit of belief one,
yeah,
and a little tingy bit of belief two. We're looking at only belief two. You've got to work this through so solidly that you know it like you know your name, like you know your telephone number, your date of birth. It's got to be something that you just know. People, it isn't so much that people are pre-programmed with the concept of belief. You actually figure it out by looking at things. Let me explain. I believe in the world there are candlestick makers. It's a belief I have. Do you know why I believe that? Because right in front of me are two candlesticks. And I know from my life experience, they just didn't pop up. So there must be someone that made them. I believe there are carpenters and joiners, because otherwise this wouldn't be here. It's obvious that I would believe that someone put the sun on its axis and spins it exactly correctly with a set of mathematical laws that also had to be written. That's obvious. And if you wouldn't accept it, we would genuinely call that person a fool. Just came from nothing, just popped out of nowhere, and just keeps doing what... You got something that does this in your garden the whole time. All day and all night, goes round in a circle. Would you worship that person? There are plenty of Gentiles who worship the sun. What can it do? Apart from just spin and shine. It's not going to give you anything.
Gives you
skin cancer. It does what it does, but it can't make the choice to do it. It's obviously under something else's directional control. Come on, that makes sense. Kobe, does that make sense?
Yeah, whatever, it can't make sense. Whatever, I'm tired, it's been a long day.
Kobe's voice has changed, did you know that? Sounds a bit like Rabbi Goodentag. That was a last week joke of my Rabbi Goodentag impression, which people this week missed. It was a really bad impression, by the way. it really was a really bad impression. Who was here for Rabbi Goodentag's impression? That was really bad, hey. Sorry, Rabbi Goodentag, if you're listening, it was a really bad impression.
His wife and daughter are.
Oh, it was a terrible impression. So it's like this. It's obvious that it exists. It's obvious that it has to be. A human being is a rational, intellectual creature. It walks around looking for reason. Play, children play, to figure things out. Big things suck up small things, and small things can't suck up big things. Just play with it. They play with the blocks. They do it over and over again to learn about the world. It's obvious that there are laws and rules. This is a law and a rule like any other. And humans are programmed to look for patterns, laws and rules in their environment. That's what we do. We're very good at it. So it's, if you just look at things honestly, you'll find there's a law and a rule that everything's been designed and is being ordered and maintained, obviously. How would you possibly say it isn't? Unless you're trying to look for another law and rule which is already maintained by a governing body. Think about it. Chaos is maintained by laws and rules. You can map chaos. Everything's ordered. Anything, you know, they don't even say random anymore. Random thermal energy is now called thermal energy. There's nothing random. The smoke coming from a cigarette is mappable, following laws and rules. How it'll break in the air current. It's obvious! This isn't a Karl Marxian, well, if you're religious, you should just be, it's like taking opium, man, you're trying to make yourself feel good, it's all in your power. It's all in your, what, are you crazy? What, the air is just perfectly balanced with the right amount of nitrogen, so it inflates your lungs, so the oxygen getting the carbon dioxide get out. Who put the air there? Communism put the air there? The people put the air there? Come on! Obviously, it's been designed.
I'll tell him off, mate.
No, it's a brilliant question. Matt, I want to tell you about the sun and the moon being the same size. That's an awesome idea. It would only work for a human to see. The sun and the moon are the same size. The Torah says, the sun and the moon are the same size.
When you're not, same angle.
Ever seen a total lunar or solar eclipse? What do you see when that happens?
Nothing.
You see the corona radiata, the flames on the outside, which means the disk of the moon is exactly the same size as the disk of the sun, but only when viewed by a human being on this earth at this distance. In absolute terms, the sun is huge and the moon's teeny. But if you put it just at the right angle, they're the same size. The Torah says the great one, because it's much brighter throughout the day, and the small one, the lesser one, but they're both the same size. They're two luminaries of the same size to you. It was a law written for humanity. The way you perceive the world, you're going to see two disks in the sky. A big yellow one and one that isn't so bright. The big yellow one is called the sun, and the one that isn't so bright, we're going to call the moon. That's an awesome idea. Which means someone must have put it there, knowing that a mammalian primate eye that sees, like, not like a crab that has like movable pupils, a man and I that we understand, looking through the troposphere, will see two disks exactly the same size as it perceives it.
Why does it matter?
Because the Torah said, because the Torah describes that both they're a different power, but it discusses them in the concept of the same size. Why would it do that if we know astronomically that's clearly not the case? Right. That is different because it's down. It's not. Please, I know that it's late. Has anyone here bought a washing machine? Has anyone ever bought a washing machine? Have you bought a washing machine? When you open the manual, does it talk like this? This washing machine was made with 748 rivets and metal that was mined in Nicaragua. It has been spray painted by people that are being paid underneath the minimum wage of their particular country. The glass that was used is made of silica and sand. Have you ever seen a washing machine manual like that? This is my washing machine manual. Open door, clothes in, press button, nice clothes out. Good. That's a washing machine manual. And it's here for its use, not a history manual of the actual what metals went into the rivets. The rivets are made of magnesium zinc alloy. Who cares? Does it clean my clothes? The Torah that's been given to us is a manual. Clearly written by someone who understands it perfectly. And he's giving it to a creature that must now utilize the world it's in. Sun and the moon, two discs. They're discs, flat discs, same size. Use them, you've got to make a calendar. First mitzvah given to the people of Israel. Make a calendar. First mitzvah given to the people of Israel. Semi-calendrical system. You're going to need the sun and moon perfectly aligned for that. Don't worry, I've organized it. When Neil Armstrong came back from the moon, it's an interesting thing. The top surface of the moon is covered in what?
Cheese.
No. Wensleydale.
Dust.
What kind of dust? What dust is it made from?
Silica.
Silica. What kind of silica is it? What is silica? What is silica?
Glass.
The moon is covered in glass beads. Why would that be? To reflect the sun. Which means it is designed. And that's what Torah says. The Torah says it's designed to reflect. It's like a night lamp. Why would it be covered in glass? It's a cat's eye. It's a ginormous cat's eye. It's clearly been designed. It's a giant cat's eye. Cat's eye is a ball of glass like those in pans. It's covered in silica. Nobody can answer why that would be. For us, it's obvious because its purpose is to be reflective. And glass is reflective. It's obvious. It's not a religious thing that I feel as if I need to have because it makes me feel nice and warm inside before bedtime. This is something that is obvious. It's as obvious as anything in the world.
So why is human nature not to recognise the obvious?
Because that's what we need to do so we can choose to recognise it. Otherwise, we would have no individual belief or perception at all, and we would actually subsume into the global consciousness, which is what Buddhism believes. Buddhism says you shouldn't have your own choice. Sit under a waterfall and just flow into the universal consciousness. Judaism says just the opposite. Be yourself perfectly. Be individual as much as you can. Express yourself as intensely as possible within the system that has been set up for you. Do it any way you want, as long as you're generally within the regular order of the environment. You have to make a green belt, according to Torah law. Can't chop down fruit trees. Can't do it. Not allowed. Because there's certain environmental realities you have to be aware of. This is how I've designed the system. Use it correctly. This is obvious stuff. Madam, you had a question.
Well, it wasn't a question. It was just a statement that you keep, like, as Sue was saying, we all say it's obvious, but there must be a creator. It's obvious. How can there not be? And yet we have so many people who are so anti. You know, I've got a friend who is like so... He's so frum in his atheism that he's like...
You should know.
...frum it, and he's like so anti.
You're saying such a... People who are atheists... So people who are atheists are true religious zealots. I'd like to point... I am not... I'm going to say that... I can't believe I'm going to say this. Who knows how this is going to get edited? I'm not religious. If I was religious, I'd just believe all this. I don't. I question everything. And I rip it apart. That's not being a religious person. That's looking at something and ripping it apart like I would a piece of Lego or anything like that. If you just walk down the road and go, all this order, these candlesticks, everything like that, it's just been made back and just popped up out of nowhere. And I'm going to believe it. No matter what you say, it's an intense zealousy of religious belief in the more Christian kind of dynamic of just, I believe it. Don't come to me with answers, because you know what he's terrified of, or she's terrified of this person? They're terrified of the truth. They're terrified. And they will do anything to avoid it. The very fact that such people exist, the very fact that they're terrified of it, proves the point that it must be real. Otherwise, they wouldn't be scared of anything. Think about it. You can only be scared of that which is... Do you see what I'm saying? If you're saying, listen, I've got to live my life, which I, now everything's just made up. You know what? It's all an accident. And don't come to me with answers or reasons. That must mean the only reason you're doing that is to avoid the evident truth that you're terrified of. Which proves the point that there is an evident truth which is terrifying them. Which means it must be real.
He doesn't come across as being that sort of person. He's more, I would say, ridiculing of everybody else.
That ridicule only comes out of the concept of self-weakness. Mm-hmm. You only ridicule or bully others because you're weak inside. You would only ridicule another religion if you honestly felt as if maybe there's something there which I need to look down, because I feel uncomfortable about it, because it is, because I'm not. And I don't have it. So I'll just, it's easy for me to say, I'll delete the problem by saying it doesn't exist. Clearly that shows a weakness. You can't deny obvious, evident truth. How can you? If you do...
So
probably best you don't. It's a tough crowd anyway, like I need that. You know what I mean? Especially with, you know, Karen over there. I don't know, there's one. Something you said is all right. What about the rest of it? I mean, I'm trying, people. I am trying. I've got one more question. Okay, you know what? We're going to take one more question. And then we are actually genuinely, honestly, really going to call it quits, and people actually come up to me and force me to answer their questions. And that last question is from the gentleman at the back with his hand up.
If Hashem is perfect, well, how do we get close enough to him to... It's very, very difficult.
What's your name, sir?
Isaac Christ.
Leslie. Yeah. Leslie is asking an unbelievable question. If this thing that you're talking about is really as good as you're really saying it is, then what are we going to do? Because we're like little bit of things licking on... It's a stone called the earth, and we're like doing this and going, hello. What have we got... Oh. Do you hear the question? If Paul, do you need to go?
No, more.
Are you okay to answer this question? Yeah. So Leslie's saying, what you're basically saying, what does he want us for? Is that really the question you're asking? Yeah. What does he want us for? Leslie, what can be the only answer to that? If he doesn't want you because he doesn't need you, why does he want you? Because you, Richard in the middle said, because you need him. Now, why would he want you to need him?
your own perfection.
And Elaine says you'll get better. Elaine, we see how we're doing this? Elaine, what's the point of that? Now think really deeply. You're right. Sorry, I just need to recapture. He said, what are we need him for? So Richard in the middle says, because you need him. Then I said, well, why would he need him? And Elaine said, because the more we would need him, the more perfect we would become. Elaine, why would we need to become more perfect? Leon said to get close to him. That's the same level. To get more perfect is mean to become closer, which is back to the same thing.
There's
that
something to which we do not yet know.
Sorry. Why would it give us pleasure? What is the pleasure behind it?
Because we experience our essence by becoming closer.
But why would we need to do that?
Improvement.
Why would we need to improve? What actually is the essence of the pleasure? Why is Elaine says that it's going to help us get better? What is the essence of really what we're doing? Think about it. We said that if we do this, we're going to get more perfect. Oh, Dovey Common hits the net. Bing, 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 bing. We're going to be more similar to God. What's the point of being more similar to God? Oh, don't go backwards. If we're getting closer to God, if we're becoming more similar to God, what's the good bit of that? So what?
We're born in his image, so we're kind of connecting the
If we're going to get more perfect, what's the big deal of that?
So we become more godlike, therefore...
You're right, we become more godlike. What's
we're
the...
just unity.
Become
one with God.
That's the concept of purpose. Why do we get pleasure? You get pleasure because those signals are telling you I'm more mimicking the Creator. All he could do, all, you hear these words? All he could do was to create something which could mimic him, because he's the ultimate perfection. There's nothing else he can do. Do you hear these words? There's nothing else he can do. If he's, look, I'm back on the 2D land. Hello, 2D people. Hello, big person. Do you have a message for us, oh three-dimensional being? Yes, I do. There's an infinitely greater dimension than yours. All I can give you is perception of that. I'm not going to give him a toy car in his world. I'm going to tell him there's something in a world greater than him.
So God wants us to be in his world.
No, he doesn't live in a world. He can't be in a world because no world could cope with him. All he wants is that you get as close to him and mimic him as much as possible. Doesn't look in the Torah. The Torah says God looks after widows and orphans. God's extremely righteous and kind. Do you know what he wants to do? Look after widows and orphans and be righteous and kind. What's the point of that? The point is not because it's intrinsically good, oh, it's good not to kill people. No, it's good to mimic the Creator, because there's nothing else you can do. And there's nothing else he can give you, except for the ability on your lowest dimensional level to mimic him. There is nothing else. What else could there be? Think about it. There is nothing else. What else would he give us? The yacht in St. Moritz? Doesn't help. All we have, coming back to Richard in the middle, does this not make us just feel good? If you realise the whole world, the air conditioning systems in here have been plumbed, and the lights have been plumbed, and there was a sparky that came in here and put everything together, it's so obviously real, the best thing you could do is get in touch with the designer, the architect. Why did the architect make, how does he make things? He makes things through loving kindness. So if I do things through loving kindness, which, by the way, are encoded as commandments, then I will mimic him as much as I can. The more you do loving kindness, the more you mimic him. The more you mimic him, the better it is. The better it is, the better it is for you, because you're now starting to form a relationship with this infinite thing, which is telling you, this is what I do. This is how I exist. This is how I be. If you be like that, you're much more like me. So what I would tell these 2Ders is walk on a particular path, which obviously is flat, but it'll be a diagram. You know, in chemistry, there are these, you draw things, so some things are going into the paper, some things are coming out of the paper. In art, you have that as well, right? So I would draw something flat on the paper for them that would be a symbol of going into the paper and coming out of the paper. And they'd walk across it and go, hold on, this isn't a flat paper. You're talking about something going into the paper. We've never experienced that. Suddenly they have a revelation. They have a religious moment. They go, there's a dimension outside of our own. You're like, oh, now you're onto something, boy. Now you're onto something. That's what he's doing. He's getting us to walk a path which mimics him to show us there's something outside of our own dimension. And that something is hidden. Nothing's better than that. Close you get, better it is for you. There's nothing else he can give you. What else could he give you? If he gave you anything else, it would be imperfect, which means he couldn't give it to you. He can't give you anything else. There's nothing else he has to give. He doesn't have anything in his bank to give you apart from that. They're all expressions of him. What's he going to give you? Lego?
Yeah.
Hmm? Mashiach, you don't understand. Mashiach is not a present. Mashiach
no,
is an out.
Suggesting it's a present.
It's an outcome of the natural order that there must be an exile and redemption.
If we get all of those,
everything we do is only coming to this point, as Elaine said, to develop our perfection. Why? Because the more you're perfect, the more you resonate with the infinite consciousness. That's how you show your love for him. That's how you love him. How could you give him? Love is all about giving. The root of ahava is hav, to give. You can't give him anything. You know what you can give him? Your obedience. There's nothing else you have to offer him. What else are you going to give him? What doesn't he have already? What he doesn't have is your obedience. Kol bidei shemaim, rak yir shemaim. All is in the hands of heaven, except for the fear of heaven. That's down to you. You want to give that to him? That's your dibs. You'll resonate with him. You don't? You don't. That's why we err. He's not a being in a world. You can't contain him. You can't put him in a box. You can't say he's squared off and I'll put him on a shelf and, you know, I'll think about something else next week. This is all there actually is. And you live in it. Work in it. Breathe in it. Clothe in it. Bathe in it. Respire in it. Live in it. Die in it. That's all there is. Nothing else. And that's the answer to your question. He only created the universe to give something else an opportunity to commune or resonate with him, because there's nothing else he could possibly offer you, because he's perfect, and anything else he'd give you is already deficient, and he can't give something deficient. So all he can give you is him. He's limited by the boundaries of his own perfection, which answers Dovi Coleman's question of, why couldn't he just put us in the next world where we'd already get there? Because you need to know you got this yourself, because if you didn't, it would be an imperfect gift. Because of our frailties, and our misunderstanding, and our limited perception, which I'll get to in section two. People, you could be somewhere else. You don't understand how much, Kobe, I rate you. You could be at the ballet, you could be at the cinema, you could be in an art thing, you could be at your friend's house playing bridge. No. You could be at the bingo, and believe me, it's fun at the bingo. I like the bingo, it's good. But you know what you're doing, you were here. You came here tonight. And what did you only talk about? Could you, if someone walks up to you and says, what did you just do? And you can give them a pill and they just go, wow, you just did that. How could you explain this to them? What are we talking about here? We're talking about why we exist, why we're aspiring, why we were created, why we are mortal, why we're going to die, why the universe exists. Everything all wrapped up in one neat, packed, tidy hour. How's that? But now listen, there's a lot of people in the room. And there's a lot of years of life experience in the room. You've gone around the world, you've talked to people. Add it all together. How many years in the room? A few hundred? How is it possible for me to stand here in front of you and tell you this? Who am I? I'm just some guy from Salford. The reason I'm able to tell you this so clearly is because it must be true. The hallmark of it, why you're not turning around and going, that's preposterous, we're not rabbits living on a giant carrot, is this stuff makes imperative sense. The truth is that if you sit and think about it enough, Natalie, you got to go, don't worry about it. If it makes imperative sense, you should have found it out yourself anyway. But as I said in the first session, you were robbed. You didn't learn this in nursery. You didn't learn it in primary school. You didn't learn it in high school. You didn't learn it until now. You should have known this yesterday. People, please God, I can finish off the whole six sessions. If I can, we'll get through the entire first section. What can we do? But realize this material is intrinsically core. It will take time to settle in. Oh, it's your fantastic week.
Thank you.